Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. The world has, of course, been suffering, free and unfree, for, 15, 20 months now, from what I call the Chinese Communist Party virus. There's increasing evidence that it emanated from a biological weapons program facility, one or more, in communist China, and has cost the world dearly in terms of lost lives as well as in terms of horrific economic hardship. That is true of our country. It is true of many others as well. A man who has been involved now for some time in trying to help the world contend with terrible diseases is our first guest. His name is Dr. Michael Yeadon. He served as the vice president of Pfizer. In big pharma terms, it is one of the biggest of the big pharmaceutical firms. He was there for some 16 years, working on allergy and respiratory research. He is a PhD who has studied closely virology and pharmacology. He is a successful entrepreneur as well, and has become, in recent months, one of the most knowledgeable, informed, and vocal skeptics about various aspects of the narrative we have been told about this so-called COVID-19 virus, as well as the treatment of it. And we've wanted to catch up with him for some time and are delighted to be able to do so today. Dr. Yeadon, thank you very much for joining us. It's good to catch you and appreciate the opportunity to hear from you firsthand some of your insights into what we are confronting in terms of this pandemic and what we should be doing about it. Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio.
It's my pleasure to be speaking to you today.
I thought I'd start with just offering you an opportunity to talk a little bit about your background, because your current position is somewhat at odds, shall we say, with that of your former employer and others in the business, as well as governments and other so-called authorities. So tell us a little bit about your bona fides, and then we'll get into your critique.
Sure, yes. Dr. Michael Yeadon, I have a first degree in biochemistry and toxicology. Then I did a research-based PhD in respiratory pharmacology. So I have kind of broad and deep understanding of biology as pertains to respiratory, immunology, inflammation, and so on. As you say, I worked...
Which would seem to be particularly relevant to this particular malady, no?
I think so. So certainly the fields of immunology, inflammation, and I would say testing, I think are a number of my strengths. So yes, my expertise, I think, is very relevant to a number of the narrative themes that have come up about this virus. So yes, in addition to working at Pfizer, and I would say I absolutely loved working at Pfizer. It's my favorite employer, fantastic employer, great facilities, really nice team. And I grew an allergy and respiratory team so that it was about 60 reporting directly to me and more than 200 through the matrix. So we had a lot of fun, frankly, until the Pfizer made a decision to exit that facility and indeed reduce in the country. After that, though, for the last 10 years, because I left in 2011, I spent the next 5 or 6 years as founder CEO of a drug company called Ziarco, Z-I-A-R-C-O. I managed to acquire a compound from my former portfolio at Pfizer. So we left on very good terms. I raised some private finance, built a team, conducted some clinical studies, which went well. And on the strength of those, the then world's biggest drug company, Novartis, acquired us for a large but undisclosed sum. So I was happy, as were my peers and Pfizer, I think, as well as the investors. A few years later, Novartis made a, to us, surprising decision to terminate that drug. But that sort of thing happens all the time, usually just the spin of the dice on relative prioritization. So as I say, I left Pfizer on very good terms and enjoyed myself. And I would say my comments about the current situation are literally coincidental. It just happens that Pfizer is one of the manufacturers of the top, you know, three or four vaccines.
But, yeah. So let's turn to your comments. You have been quite public, I think, in expressing disagreement with what you've described as a false narrative that we have been told about, I guess, not so much the provenance of this disease, but its characterization as a mortal peril to the world. Now, having said that, obviously, lots of people have died and many others been adversely affected by it. But give us, you know, sort of the corrective, as you see it, that's in order.
Yes. Okay. I'll try and do that. Yes, I do believe that this this virus has sickened and carried away, killed a number of people. I think the characteristic, however, of the people that it has hastened the death of, almost completely those who are very close to life's end anyway. And in the UK, for example, I would say the median age at death of somebody who died with COVID-19 is exactly the same age, or in fact, a few months older than the average age of people who've died from all other causes. So I think that tells you straight away that it's something that took away people who were in the last few months of their life. And just supporting that theme, ever since, the monthly death rate in UK is running cold. It's a little bit lower than normal. And I think that suggests that what we've done is pulled forward a few tens of thousands of deaths into, say, last year that would have otherwise happened over the several months of this year. So it's basically, I think there has been a massive overcount of the number of people who have died, and a general impression given that almost everybody might be unlucky and be killed by it. And neither of those two things are true.
And that characterization of the disease, of course, was used to justify the kinds of very draconian steps that were taken in your country and in at least many parts of the United States as well and elsewhere around the world, the lockdowns, as they were called. Were those unwarranted, as you see it?
Yes, absolutely. Yes, unfortunately. The way I see it, and I'm confident I can justify it, this statement, which is a big statement, every single one of the main narrative points that have been used, as far as I can tell, in every country are false, every one. And because they cannot be accidental, describe them, then I'm afraid my accusation is that whoever started it, I couldn't tell you. But the repeating of it by people who are knowledgeable can only be characterized as a lie. And I could just offer, for example...
Well, you're going to have to do it on the other side of a short break, Dr. Eden. We have to take a momentary pause here. When we come back, we will get into an expert's critique of the narratives that we have been told about COVID-19, the CCP virus, if you will, and the inappropriate steps that were taken in response to it, and the cost to us of all of the above. That and much more with Dr. Michael Eden right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
We're visiting with Dr. Michael Eden, and I'm very glad to have both you and him back for a conversation about his insights as a former senior executive at one of the preeminent pharmaceutical enterprises in the world, Pfizer, and as an entrepreneur who has worked in the space of pharmaceuticals for many years, an expert and highly accomplished researcher in the fields of allergy and respiratory diseases. Dr. Eden, again, thank you for taking the time to talk with us. You were indicating in the previous segment that you had disagreements about a number of the narratives that were components of the big narrative that we were given about this COVID-19 virus and how best to treat it. Walk us through some of the most important of those, if you would.
Yes, I'd be happy to do that. I need to be very clear, and an unusual thing for a scientist to say what I'm going to say. They usually just disagree politely. This is not, in my view, a scientific disagreement between, you know, two different competing views. I'm afraid they're lies. They're actually misleading deliberately. So I'm going to give you some examples. Let me just start off at the top. This virus, SARS-CoV-2, that was described, I think, during December 2019, 2020, January 2020, is a novel virus. And so we were told there won't be any immunity in the population. And so, you know, it could run ragged through the population, killing a lot of people. So straight away, that's not true. Although it is a novel sequence, it actually is one of seven. This is the seventh coronavirus known to infect human beings. There are four that are so-called endemic, that appear every season and contribute to what we call the common cold. So that's not frequently told. And yet there's a substantial sequence homology. That is, it's of the same family as this new virus. Now, this is very important because lots of people have been exposed to these endemic common cold causing coronaviruses. And as a result, lots of people had some degree of immunity. And I'll give you an example. Everybody has probably heard this. You know someone in another family, or maybe someone in your own family, who became PCR positive, maybe with symptoms. No one else in the family did. And that's the strongest evidence I can give that my story, that there was a huge amount of immunity in the population, was true and not false narrative.
This just gainsays, or maybe helps explain, why some of the prognostications about what the effect of this disease would be, notably out of the Imperial College of London, proved to be so erroneous. Talk about that just quickly, if you would.
Yes, exactly. And I was going to link directly to the Imperial College modeling, which I'm not a modeler, but I could certainly look at the assumptions they had used. And they did include in their assumptions pretty much that everyone was susceptible. And in fact, you would not expect them to be, because there was a lot of exposure to related viruses, coronaviruses, previously. And in addition, over the last year, there's been a lot of cutting edge empirical immunology that's been published that actually shows that there was, at a T cell level, between 30% and 50% of people had immunity to this SARS-CoV-2 already, because they had shared immunity or cross immunity, having been exposed to related viruses. So.
And this explains in part why the modeling that claimed you would have over 500,000 Brits perish and something north of 2.2 million Americans perish took hold and justified, or was said to justify, some of the draconian steps that were taken. Is that right?
Yes. I think there were two main components what I think was an error. One was that everyone's susceptible instead of only a minority. And then the other one was they used a surprisingly high number for the fraction of people who became infected that would die. So that is often classified as the infection fatality ratio. But the reason I was surprised that they'd used a very high number is that we know from epidemic after epidemic, every new pathogen, we start by rating it as being much more serious than it eventually turns out to be. Why? And it's because early on we see the very sick people. And of course, a high percentage of those people who present at hospitals very ill, they will die. What we learn later always is that there's a long shadow, a long penumbra of people who are infected but less severely affected. And then there's an even longer tail of people who are infected and have no symptoms at all. And that is what has happened. We knew it would happen. We knew it would lower the infection fatality ratio by between 3 and 10-fold. It always happens. And you'll now see that Dr. John Ioannidis, I think, of Stanford, now is rating the infection fatality ratio of not very different from a standard seasonal influenza. And that's the trajectory everybody would have expected. But no, Imperial decided to start at the Wuhan figures and assume they would still be true later, and it wasn't true.
So another piece of this that I know you have been very worried about was the kind of data that arose as a result of some of these so-called PCR testing inaccuracies. Talk a bit about that, if you would, because we were told for much of the early days of this pandemic, in the United States at least, that it was all about testing. We had to get the testing, you know, done everywhere, and that would be the definitive proof of the degree to which we really were at great risk. What's your take on all of that?
Yeah. Well, you may have seen the occasional clip of Dr. Carrie Mullis, who invented PCR, polymerase chain reaction, won a Nobel Prize for it. He's now dead, unfortunately. But he said, and I agree, that this amplification technique, which uses cycles of amplification, is not suitable at all for judging whether somebody is infected or infectious. And there have been at least three court adjudications in Europe that have confirmed what I've just said. It's not suitable as a test of infectiousness or even being infected.
Well, that's a rather significant problem with the process, is it not?
Absolutely.
It's no laughing matter, really.
It is a fatal blow, in my view. But let me just say that in addition to pretending that it is a good test of infection, the authorities, as far as I can tell around the world, certainly in my country and many European countries, they used too many cycles of amplification. So let me just say, there's a tiny amount of a tiny amount of viral RNA, which is what you're trying to measure, in amongst a what would be biologically a dirty sample if you put a swab up somebody's nose or around their tonsils, and you're trying to identify if there's a tiny amount of this viral RNA. And what you do is you put very specific primers, things that will match specifically to this virus and only this virus. And what you should do is multiply it just enough times to be able to extract it from the background. What you shouldn't do is keep turning the handle of amplification, because if you do that, not all the time, but almost every time, you can get a positive even when nothing is there, because you just end up amplifying noise. And what is now reasonably well understood, and even the WHO have clarified this, I think only in the last couple of months, is they've said, don't run the amplification more than, say, low 30s. And I think they've even qualified it to maybe 28 or 25. But most countries in the world were running between 38 and 42 cycles. And if I tell you that each incremental count doubles the amount of material, so a difference of 3 or 4 in the cycle count represents another order of magnitude difference. And it was my assertion all the way through last year, and I received a lot of criticism for it, but I'm confident I was correct, that the vast majority of the so-called case count were false positives, and there was bad behavior, really bad behavior. I know how to do PCR. I know how to do assaying and making tests. You always must define what the false positive rate is. All tests that are used on scale, all medical diagnostic tests, have some propensity to go positive when nothing is there. And you should always know what that number is.
Yeah. So let me just translate this, if I may, into layman's language. You're saying that the testing that was done in a very high percentage of the cases could have given rise to false positives, as they're called, an assessment that somebody has the disease when they actually don't, which would have given rise to obviously inflated numbers of infections and cases and deaths, I guess, ultimately as well. No? So this brings me to another question that you've also expressed concerns about, and this coming from somebody who has been intimately involved in the past with research at an institution like Pfizer, has, I think, special noteworthiness, shall we say. You're concerned that the vaccines have not been adequately tested to assure their safety, even in the short term, let alone over the long term. Is that correct?
Yes, I'm afraid so. And it's not specifically a blow at Pfizer, and I wouldn't say it's specifically Pfizer's fault either. It is a consequence of the relatively short time between their discovery, you know, their initial manufacture, and the amount of time that elapsed until somebody said, okay, under emergency use authorization, you may now administer it en masse to the population. It was just a few months. Well, in just a few months, you can only get a few months worth of linear types of time safety data. And
if you're going at warp speed, you travel at warp speed. Is I guess the bottom line, no?
And this is very important. No amount of scale, doesn't matter how many people you expose a new substance to, if the question is what are the effects over time, there is simply no substitute for time elapsed. You cannot infer it, even from a million or 10 million people. Say there was an unwanted effect that would occur reproducibly after, say, 3 or 4 months, and you had no data beyond 3 months. You can have no sight of it. It doesn't matter whether you've dosed 10 people or 10 million people, you have no sight of it. So there's no linear safety data beyond, I think it was 2.5 or 3 months. So God help us if it turns out there are serious as moderate or long-term side effects. God help us, seriously.
No, I couldn't agree more, obviously. Let me ask you about one specific side effect that I think you've been described as having raised concerns about that some found unwarranted. I think the British government, for example, did on the fertility of females who've been given the vaccine. Let me take a break because we're over time. We'll come back and we'll get into this issue of the fertility question with Dr. Michael Yeadon, formerly of Pfizer, now a very outspoken critic of the narratives we've been told about the COVID-19 pandemic. Talk with him about infertility and more right after this.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
We're continuing our conversation with Dr. Michael Yeadon, a man who knows a lot about the respiratory and allergic diseases that afflict humankind and has brought this knowledge to bear now as a rather prominent critic of the way in which the, I call CCP virus, the Chinese Communist Party virus, also known as the COVID-19 virus, has been handled by governments and, well, the medical community as well. And one issue that you have been criticized for raising, and I did want to give you a chance to illuminate it further, is the question of whether females who've been inoculated with these vaccines are at risk of becoming infertile. Talk about that if you would, sir.
Yes. Let me just take a step back, though. And 1st of December 2020, along with a medical doctor, Dr. Wolfgang Vodarg of Germany, I wrote a petition to the European Medicines Agency, pleading with them, frankly, to slow down. And it was not to do with potential impact on pregnancy. Our primary concern, which anyone would know if they've read the petition, was these are novel type of products. No one has yet been dosed with this gene-based immunomodulator. There's no lateral history, as I say, over time. And so our concern was that we simply had not been possible to collect enough information to know whether or not they were safe. We did have a number of specific concerns, though, and I will mention just two. One was the presence of a particular chemical which could cause allergic reactions. This is called polyethylene glycol. And the other one was the potential for similarity between the sequence of the vaccine and a human pregnancy hormone. So let me just take those in order. One, we said we noticed that polyethylene glycol was an excipient, part of the manufacture. And we were concerned because we knew from the literature that quite a percentage of people have antibodies to this polyethylene glycol, and therefore it would be possible that people would have allergic reactions. And you know what? In the UK, on the very first day they started dosing, two people got severe anaphylactoid reactions and had to be rescued with EpiPens. So that doesn't sound like we were wrong. And these, remember, are the details. Our big concern was you don't know what's going to happen. And in fact, we should come back to blood clots because we now know things that we didn't know then. So the pregnancy hormone potential, I would say it simply has not been eliminated. It was not top of my list. What we noticed was that spike protein, which is part of the coronavirus, and it's the part that the vaccine causes your body to make temporarily. You become a virus protein manufacturer briefly, and you make this spike protein. It turns out that the spike protein is of the same a protein family as a pregnancy-supporting hormone called syncytin. So they're not very close. People who would criticize me said, well, they're not very similar. I would agree they're not very similar, but they are definitely of the same family. And when you think of it like that, it means that when this protein is bunched up, folded up in its native conformation inside a body, I think it's not impossible that some people will make antibodies to the gene-based spike protein, and some of those antibodies might cross-react in some women with their pregnancy-supporting hormone. And I would say, rather than arguing with me, why don't you do the experiment? They still not done the experiment, to my knowledge, after a year.
Well, and this really goes to the heart of the larger problem. You touched on this in passing, and I'd like you just to spend a minute, if you would, talking again to this layman and perhaps many laymen in our audience as well. A gene-based immunomodulator is different than the vaccines that we have used in the past. How would you characterize that difference? And why does that add urgency to your point about how we cannot know the effects, particularly over time, of this new kind of therapy?
Yes, I think I can characterize the difference really easily. And I think people will know they know this when I say to it them what this is. Traditional vaccines, I think, have always involved taking a piece of the pathogen, the organism that you want to protecting against. It's normally grown up in a test tube or a dish of cells until you've got enough of it. And then it's purified in some way. And then it's killed. We don't infect you generally with a full strength pathogen. We will either kill it with heat, we'll kill it with chemicals, or we will let it multiply again and again and again until it weakens. And that's called an attenuated vaccine. So those are the three things. It's a piece of the pathogen, not the whole pathogen. And we'll just give you a little piece of it, but it is the genuine pathogen. And so you'll just get a single dose of that. It'll distribute around your body. Some of it will go to your immune tissue, your lymph nodes, your tonsils, and so on. And then you'll manufacture antibodies and T cell responses to that. And you'll end up with a memory of it. And so if you see the real live organism, wow, you'll come out fighting. But that's not what you're getting with the gene-based immunomodulators or gene-based vaccines. What they do is encode a piece of this foreign organism, and they make your cells be briefly taken over and manufacture a piece of that. Now, a piece of the pathogen. Now, the main problem I've got specifically with the choice of what they encoded in the vaccines, all of them, coincidentally, have all chosen the spike protein, which is the little spike you see sitting out on the ball and stick model of the coronavirus. They've all chosen pretty much the same thing. And that's the problem I have with it, is they must not have looked at the published literature, because we knew from the original SARS, the 2003 severe acute respiratory syndrome virus, that the spike protein is capable of triggering human blood clotting. And so as soon as I saw what they were doing, I became really quite agitated, checked my literature. I'm afraid there are plenty of experimental papers that show that spike protein on its own is capable of causing clumping and coagulation. And what a surprise, then, it turns out that blood clots are one of the major side effects of these gene-based vaccines. I literally told them that this would happen.
And Dr. Yudin, let me just ask you, when you say it's a major, you know, a side effect, how major is it? And is it sufficiently commonplace to, under other circumstances, have warranted a suspension of these vaccines or perhaps their withdrawal from the market altogether?
Yes, it's not. So that is not an area, I wouldn't say, so pharmacovigilance, that's what would be called pharmacovigilance. That's not an area of competency of mine. So I did have to look this up. And I know that in the past, with vaccines against, say, swine flu and a virus even earlier, there were a whole lot fewer fatalities associated with dosing with earlier vaccines that triggered their withdrawal from the market. So I would say,
as an example, as I understand it, 50 instances prompted the swine flu virus to be withdrawn.
Exactly.
And do we have any sense of the numbers of people who have been fatally afflicted with these kinds of blood clots or related problems?
Well, certainly in the UK, there are in excess of 1,000 people whose deaths have been recorded to have followed fairly quickly after vaccination with either the AstraZeneca or the Pfizer products. And I believe in the US, I think it's in excess of 4,000. They won't all be from blood clots, but you know, perhaps half of that number. There seems to be a clutch of neurological side effects that might be circulatory related or different. And there are definitely a whole bunch of people who've had coronaries or strokes.
I know of several of myself, as a matter of fact. So the bottom line here is that you are arguing, based on your experience in the business, the research side, as well as the treatment of people witnessing, you know, their progress with the various products that you've been associated with, that more testing is urgently needed on these vaccines. And we should not be, I take it, demanding that people assume the risk of taking these vaccines at this point. Is that your general view? Have I characterized it correctly?
Yes. No, I think that's absolutely fair. I think another thing I do need to mention, that there's been a prevailing sort of mainstream media sense that there are no treatments that can be given for people who've got COVID-19 and have symptoms. So if you're not sick enough to get to hospital, you just have to suffer. Whereas there was very recently some very good work done by Dr. Peter McCullough, who's a very famous, a cardiac pharmacologist and physician. And there are now published, based on work he's done for the American Association of Physicians and Surgeons on their website, you will see a whole collection of drugs that people will be familiar with, like the hydroxychloroquine, the azithromycin, and a variety of other pharmacological therapies. If these had been distributed and not suppressed, I think there really would not have been a need to have rushed the fences with these vaccines. And I think standard safety testing could have and probably should have been done.
And one other piece of this, as I understand your critique, is that only by suppressing or otherwise essentially ruling out the use of hydroxychloroquine, for example, and some of these other treatments, could the conditions have been satisfied that allowed emergency use of these vaccines? Is that correct?
Yes, that is correct. I went to look at in both Europe and the US, and you are right. In order that basically this expedited or emergency use authorization be granted to drugs that, medical products that are essentially still in development. Phase 3 does not complete until 2023, I think, for most of these vaccines. In order for that expedited approval, there has to be essentially nothing else that can be done.
It's genuinely an emergency, in other words.
Absolutely. A big claim here. See, if I'm wrong, you better knock me down, critics. I would say this virus is probably the best, the most treatable respiratory virus we've ever come across. The number of treatment modalities that Dr. Peter McCullough and other Pierre Corey across the world have put together is second to none, ranging from inhaled steroids. That was an area I was very familiar with in my allergy and respiratory days, but certainly certain antibiotics that have anti-inflammatory properties, the hydroxychloroquine and so on. There are literally half a dozen different classes of off-patent, relatively safe or very safe medicines. So they really should have been rolled out. And I think it's close to criminal that they have been repressed or suppressed.
I want to pick up on that point on the other side of our last short break. We'll be right back with Dr. Michael Yeadon right after this.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back to the fourth and final installment of this remarkable conversation with a former senior executive of Pfizer, who has become a very vocal and I think quite impressive critic of some of the ways in which we have been told this so-called COVID-19 disease operates. His name is Dr. Michael Yeadon. You mentioned at one point there were some percentage of individuals who had the COVID virus who were asymptomatic. Clarify that point. Can they be asymptomatic and actually have the disease? Or if they don't have symptoms, do they actually have it?
We would generally not count somebody who didn't have symptoms as having a disease, but it is certainly possible possible that you could be carrying small amounts of the virus in your airways and have no symptoms. And that we would just call asymptomatic carriage. But if you don't have much virus in your airways, you're simply a very poor source of infection to other people. And the general rule of thumb is if you don't have symptoms, you don't have enough on board to represent an infection risk to others.
Talk a little bit about variants to this disease.
Yes, certainly. I would regard immunology as one of my strongest suits. So I'm very confident about what I'm going to tell you, that although it is true that this virus does create errors, typographical errors when it replicates, the degree to which the variants are different from the original virus is incredibly tiny. The most different variant from the original is only 0.3% difference. So putting it another way, it's 99.7% the same as the original one. And I can assure you there is no possibility whatsoever that a variant that differs that slightly will fool your immune system and bypass your immunity, however it was gained. No chance whatsoever. So if people tell you you need top-ups for variants, you have to look behind their hand, because I don't believe it's true.
In other words, the potential risks associated with getting still more of the vaccine in your system, if there are long-term effects, are not justified by the kind of potential benefit that you might receive from doing that.
There's simply no need to modify the immunity you've already acquired, either through natural infection or through immunization by a vaccine. You don't need to modify it at all.
Dr. Yeadon, one of the things that has been bruited as needed now is to differentiate and ultimately to discriminate between people who have been vaccinated and people who have not. Governments, to some extent, are adopting so-called vaccine passports. In some cases, as in the United States at the moment, the U.S. government is not doing that, but it is seemingly quite happy to have private sector enterprises do it. Talk us through the vaccine passport idea and its advisability.
Yes, I personally don't think there is any advantage whatsoever in having a vaccine passport. That is an app or a piece of paper that says I've been vaccinated. And the reason is very simple. If you are a person who is vulnerable and you've chosen to be immunized and it's gone well, and you are now protected, you don't need to know the immune status of anyone around you. You are protected by your immunization. And it's as simple as that. And if you don't require vaccination, again, you're not interested in knowing anyone's immune status. So vaccine passports add absolutely nothing to the sum total of human safety. And they're a complete irrelevance.
But they could be used for the purpose that I believe the lockdowns were initially, at least in part, justified, of course, by these various narratives, medical and so on. But in practice, a control mechanism, in some cases, rather ruthless control mechanism at that. Talk about the lockdown as an appropriate response to what you've shared with us so far.
Yes, I can do that, I think, quite swiftly. I mentioned just a few minutes ago that if you don't have symptoms because you have either no virus in your airways or too little to be a source of infection, then you're not a respiratory health threat to anybody. You don't need a mask to stop you infecting someone you already can't infect them. And similarly, you don't need to be locked down. Now, the reason lockdowns have been studied and proven not to have slowed epidemic spreading anywhere in the world is for that reason I just described. Infection generally didn't happen out in the community because infection requires a heavily symptomatic person. Now, a heavily symptomatic person is ill. An ill person is much more likely to be deselected from the community, much more likely to have stayed at home. And so I don't think much transmission happened in the general community, and therefore lockdowns didn't inhibit it. It was mostly taking place in the institutions and occasionally at home, neither of which were affected by lockdown. So lockdown was a completely hopeless, ineffective response to the epidemic, and all it did is produce pain for no gain.
Considerable pain, and we may not fully understand the long-term costs of that either for a period to come. Doctor, let me just ask you one last question, and it's a little bit farther afield perhaps, but you walked us through sort of the biology of this disease a moment ago, and I just wanted to ask you about the provenance of it. Have you given thought to whether this was, in fact, this spike protein in particular was engineered in a fashion that did not come from nature and that may have had something to do with its contagiousness and such lethality as it has demonstrated?
Yes, I have read a couple of really quite long reports, and it was with a heavy heart, to be absolutely honest with you, that I'm led to the conclusion on the balance of probabilities. It does look like it is the product of lab work, in that I'll just say this, that if you want to attach two pieces of protein together, that there are some standard tools that you would buy from a catalog. And if you make a particular butt join of two bits of code or protein, you find characteristic joining pieces at each end. Unfortunately, those characteristic joining pieces are found in this sequence, and they're not found in any of the other six coronaviruses. So I am led, unfortunately, to that conclusion that is being mooted, that it could well be the product of lab work.
Now, does that alter in any way your contention that the transmissibility of this disease or variants to it may behave as we would expect similar diseases naturally occurring to present?
No, I don't think I could make that claim. I know that there are other common cold-causing coronaviruses that do seem to have a similar transmittability. So I can't claim there's anything particularly unique about this. I think however, SARS-CoV-2 does seem to combine the unpleasant pathology of the original SARS, or at least some components of that, a little bit worse than common colds, with the transmissibility of some of the common colds. So, yes, maybe it is a combination, but I don't really think I'm adding anything particularly incisive to that point.
Okay, last question, if I may. Having worked in the pharmaceutical industry, any thoughts on the advisability of making the patents available to others that are associated with these vaccines?
I must say, I'm generally supportive of the pharmaceutical industry. I think if you've done the work, you put in the investments at risk, I think you should have a right to exclusive use. And if somebody wants to deprive you of that, then they should compensate you.
That seems eminently sensible to me, but there also seems to me to be a pretty important public policy issue here, whether you want to make available to competitors of your pharmaceutical industry seed corn technology like that's been involved here.
You can tell that I'm very sympathetic still of the industry I worked for 32 years in. I would want to compensate the company that put the investment in and has created a novel and useful invention. I can understand there may be a public policy imperative that will say you're not going to get the exclusive use, but should that happen, I think they should be compensated.
Yeah. No, I'm making really the opposite point, which is, quite apart from compensation, there's a question of whether you wish to have competitors to this country, which have demonstrated a propensity, and particularly in the case of China, to hollow out our industrial base. Steal our seed corn technology and use it to drive us out of the business is advisable.
Yeah, I would be inclined to be protective. I was just acknowledging that if there was an imperative, you would need to compensate. But yes, my preference is to stand by the standard trade that we have between inventing something, putting it in the public domain, and having an exclusive use. I think that's a very good cyst, by the way.
Dr. Michael Yeadon, thank you for your time today and for spending a full hour with us to go through your many insights into this very substantial challenge that we continue to face. And your thoughts on how best to face it are very appreciated. I think you've established yourself as somebody who is not anti-vaccination, not somebody who is anti-pharma, the pharmaceutical industry, and very much ProPublica, if I can use that expression, trying to make sure that the public interest is well served throughout all of this. Come back to us with updates, if you would. And I hope the rest of you will come back to us again tomorrow, same time, same station, for more Secure Freedom Radio.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.